The dark signal returns. The shrine. It must be built. Maybe just with a new guy, because we had an HR issue with one dude who was kind of problematic, but that's okay. That's okay. We can build the shrine without him. Maybe just build a smaller shrine. Literary critic and rare combination of bully nerd Harold Bloom once wrote, "After Jesus, Hamlet is the most cited figure in Western consciousness. No one prays to him, but no one evades him for long either."
What does he mean, no one prays to him? I mean, yeah, no one prays to him. That'd be weird, right? Right?
So I have to admit that there are a handful of figures in the early development of heavy metal that I wasn't expecting to talk so much about when I started this podcast, but the more I research how the music as we know it came to be, they just keep showing up at really important historical moments like Aleister Crowley or Forrest Gump. As Black Sabbath began to deteriorate due to arguments about whether they should be more like Foreigner or more like a band that only included Ozzy Osbourne, Judas Priest and Iron Maiden were picking up metal where Sabbath left off. Now, obviously, Rob Halford and Bruce Dickinson are very unique vocalists. But in the larger scope of heavy metal, their particular gifts had more in common with one another, and even with Ozzy, really, than any of them would with Kronos, say, of Venom, who we'll get to in a minute. But the man who introduced the possibility of something other than clean vocals wasn't exactly someone you would associate with cleanliness in any of its forms. Nor did he deliberately invent this new approach, but rather he pioneered harsh vocals because he just couldn't sing any other way. Like Hamlet, no one evades the significance of Lemmy Kilmister's contributions to metal for long. But unlike the Prince of Denmark, who no one prays to, for many metalheads, there is but one universal truth in the world, and it is this. Lemmy is God. Now, while I say Lemmy's vocal choice was unintentional, there were certain deliberate choices that he made that likely had an effect on his unique vocal style. One is drinking, and the other is smoking more than he drank. Another aspect of his technique is that Lemmy sang in his lower register, with a lot of what is called vibrato, or, as my friend Danny Teeker told me, vibrato. Because, as you all know, I cannot pronounce words. So, vibrato. Which it's just a fancy way of saying going back and forth between two pitches that are really close together. The other kind of singing is called straight tone, in which you try not to go back and forth and instead just stay on one pitch. But a lot of people think that straight tone can damage your voice, so you're probably better off becoming a heavy smoker and drinker and using lots of vibrato. The other weird quirk of Motorhead's frontman was that he insisted on putting his microphone above his head and tilting it down, which forced him to sing up at the mic. So if you're sitting with your head facing forward right now, relax your jaw and breathe, and you can feel all of that space for airflow in your throat. Now, tilt your chin toward the ceiling and take a breath. You see how that reduces the amount of space and tightens the muscles in your neck? Over time, that is going to have the unintended consequence of straining your voice and propelling you to international fame and fortune as a legendary rock star beloved by millions, so don't do that. Okay, I'm not going to get too in the weeds on technique, because I assume a lot of metal vocalists think vibrato is the reason their significant other is always running to the store for more batteries. But I am fascinated by... That was a vibrator joke, by the way. I wasn't sure if I spread the breadcrumbs too thin on that one. But lest we give Lemmy all the credit of introducing a harsher vocal quality into heavy metal, we can't ignore the occasional flourishes of the only metal band to predate Motorhead. And that band is, of course, Black Sabbath. In 1975, Sabbath released what is unquestionably the angriest album to come from their original lineup,
sabotage. And I think sometimes it's easy to forget that as ghoulish and ethereal as Ozzy Osbourne often sounded, that motherfucker could shred. That's Megalomania, the 9-minute, 42-second epic closer to the A-side of Sabotage. Sometimes when I'm working on an episode, I'll write an intro clip that I want to play, and then I read it out loud to myself and play the clip so that I can hear how it sounds. And when I did that for this song, the minute that Ozzy came in on the track, I burst into tears, like a normal person who's very mentally stable. I'm fascinated by guys like Lemmy, who produce harsh vocals in a more natural or authentic way. You're going to hear me say the word authentic a lot, because there's something about that that really resonates for me in terms of the kind of dividing line between vocals that I enjoy and vocals that I don't as much. It's very subjective, and it's kind of a dividing line for me between the authentic and something that sounds really produced, that sounds like somebody's doing a voice. Because you know, if there's anything that I really hate in the world, it's when people do voices.
Yeah, and I agree.
Oh, thanks, Nawab. So it's not an exact science, but I think you can pick up where I'm going with it and where my sort of natural tendencies lie in terms of listening to an authentic voice versus something that sounds a little bit more produced based on the terms of what I'm going to play for you. And then you, of course, can make up your own decision, because one man's authenticity is another man's, I don't know, whatever the word for the opposite of authenticity is. Nauthenticity? That's it. Nauthenticity. So I get how death metal vocalists do the growl, because it requires breath and technique that I had to learn as an actor in voice and speech classes. It's really fucking hard, and I don't want to do it. But I can hear the technique so clearly in a lot of death metal growls. But what I don't understand is how singers like Scott Kelly of Neurosis, formerly of Neurosis, Matt Pike from High on Fire, or Laura Pleasance from Kylesa can sing like that and manage not to destroy their voices completely when it sounds like their technique involves huffing on road flares and peeling open their larynx with a butcher knife dipped in hydrochloric acid. And speaking of things I never want to see, let's talk about Venom. In the early 80s, heavy metal took an unprecedented heel turn with a folding chair to the back of the authenticity that Black Sabbath and Motorhead brought to the music, as Venom's manager distracted the referee just long enough to secure a quick three count, bringing home the Intercontinental Championship belt for Evil. So I'm not really a Venom fan, because the whole Satan thing's a little gimmicky to me, but Venom wasn't the first to do it, and at least the music matched the sound. Kiss dressed up like demons and aliens just to write songs about needing to pick up some gin at the liquor store. In hell and on Saturn, apparently. I'm not sure where the kitty cat buys his gin, but I'll leave that to the scholars. But we're not here to talk about whether or not I like Venom or if Kiss sucks. But we have to give Venom credit as the next stage of evolution in metal vocals. Because even though I think it's kind of hokey, Conrad Lant, aka Kronos, the frontman for Venom, doesn't see it that way. And I have to admit that I really admire the way he talks about his music from the perspective of an artist, which is what he is. And he's kind of funny. This is Kronos from an interview with The Rock Pit in 2015, in which he talks about what inspired his particular vocal style. When punk came out, rock was so lame. It was all guys crying about how their girlfriend left them and found a lonely freeway and all this shit. See? It was funny. So I just thought rock needed a bit of growl back. It needed a bit of energy, and for me, I basically took all of those things that I thought other bands would provide, and I put that into Venom. At first, people didn't like it. They didn't get it, they didn't understand the vocal style, I can't hear what you're saying, blah blah blah. I've always been a big fan of people like Lemmy, that growly style of voice, that guttural growl. And here is that guttural growl from
from Venom's 1981 debut, Welcome to Hell. Whispering. Are the demons still napping, or what's going on? In spite of Venom coining the phrase black metal on their second album in 1982, Venom exists in this kind of liminal space between the new wave of British heavy metal and the creation of thrash, black, and death metal, all of which had their incipient releases in 1983 or 1984. Venom is really the first band to make a deliberate and conscious choice to use harsh vocals consistently in heavy metal. For the bands that came after Venom and also chose to use harsh vocals, but with slightly different or sometimes drastically different conventions, they soon turned those conventions into some of the defining features of three major subgenres that I mentioned, which developed in the early 80s: thrash metal, death metal, and black metal. And the first up is thrash. Thrash. I'm not going to spend too much time on this one except to say that of the three, early thrash provides the most variety among vocal choices, or voices choices, if you want to say it stupid. None of the frontmen from the Big Four sound much like one another. James Hetfield doesn't sound like Tom Araya, and neither of those guys sound like Dave Mustaine or Joey Belladonna. Even branching out a bit, Bobby Ellsworth of Overkill sounds more like Rob Halliford from Judas Priest than any of the other thrash singers. The most consistent thing that you can say about the thrash vocalists is that Paul Baloff, the first vocalist for Exodus, and Chuck Billy, the forever vocalist of Testament, have a similar cadence and barky quality to James Hetfield on Kill 'Em All. It's what's known as the Thrashagrian theorem: Billy squared plus Baloff squared equals Hetfield squared. And if you think that that's a really weird or discomforting way to combine things, this one's even worse. You know Neil Turbin, the lead singer of Anthrax from their first album? Yeah, he sounds like Geddy Lee from Rush. So if you want to hear what Rush would sound like if they were a thrash band, go listen to Fistful of Metal. It's fucking weird. But the real common denominator of thrash vocals that differentiates them from black and death metal is audibility. Thrash vocals aren't really harsh vocals. Not anymore, anyway, and I'm using them as a kind of inflection point at which black and death metal vocalists started to branch off from their common ancestor. For example, if you can understand about 50 to 75% of the lyrics on an album that came out between 1983 and 1989, it's probably a thrash album. And the subgenre is defined more by its frenetic pace than its vocal quality. Here's an example provided by Tom Araya of Slayer. That's Evil Has No Boundaries, a song about a territorial dispute between France, Luxembourg, and evil. See? You can kind of hear the lyrics. Just going by ear, if I were to just go, okay, first verse, I think it goes something like this. Blasting away through the boundaries of hell, no one can stop us tonight. We take all the rugs and the hatred inside. They are the reason we fight. Somebody's two daughters are killing with lust. Then we return from the dead. A tacky one, more now with twice as much trees. We conquer the poop on their head. Yeah, so like 50, 75%. Those must have been some rugs. But when it comes to heavy metal's departure into black metal, things aren't quite so cut and dried. And for death metal, things aren't so cut and dyed.
Because it's death metal. Whatever, you make a podcast then. Here's a band whose subgenre seems to be hotly debated, a choice between early black metal and early death metal from 1984. No. Wrong 1984. I'm talking about the vocal stylings of Tom Warrior from Hellhammer, who kind of straddles the line between the two genres. Take a listen.
Fucked up the skin of Rissa. Put the thrillers to a creed. Who leads a traitor? How many of them? Rump of the creation. Real religious. Aggressor.
So that's Horus Aggressor, and my buddy Greg from the So Far So Pod So What podcast on Megadeth argues that Warrior is a death metal pioneer, whereas the internet seems to believe that it's black metal. I can see the case for both because one of the big differentiators between death metal and black metal, as I can hear it, is pitch. Death growls tend to live in the lower register, and black metal vocals tend to live in the upper register. Tom Warrior is definitely living low. It's a deep, throaty sound, but the death growl requires a ton of breath so that your neck doesn't catch fire, which means death vocalists have to put out a lot of vocal energy. Black metal vocalists, if they aren't doing the super high-pitched falsetto scream, sound to me a bit like they're holding back their breath, and that is what I hear when I listen to Tom Warrior. So it's a mosaic of poor vocal health, but if it's Greg versus the internet, am I going to choose an international web of knowledge cultivated over years of harvesting and curating information for the explicit purpose of disseminating that wisdom to the masses? Or am I going to choose the internet? I think I'm sticking with Greg on this one. Thanks, but no thanks, Al Gore. All right, but enough of the soup and sandwich combos. Let's get to those albums where black and death metal truly part ways. Amicably, I might add. Death metal gets the house and the car. Black metal gets to keep their collection of Max Factor Black No. 5 foundation and exfoliating wipes. One of the most important events that catalyzed the emergence of death metal around the world happened when a group of teenagers in Florida... Wow, I had such hopes for that sentence when it started. A group of teenagers in Florida produced a series of literally underground recordings in the guitarist's basement. In 1984, a band... If you play Top Jimmy, I will end your lineage. Not a threat. A promise. In 1984, a band called Mantis released their demos under the title Death by Metal, which made their way around the world through the tape trading culture of the early 80s. Many will argue that Pentagram by Possessed in 1985 is the first death metal record, but Death by Metal only gets short shrift because it wasn't properly released as an album until years later. The quality is not great, but the novelty of the sound is unmistakable. The voice that you will hear is that of a young man named Cam Lee, who I think you can hear for the first time giving life to the sound of death. That guitar riff sounds familiar, it's because that is the man himself, future guitarist and vocalist for the band I think of as quintessential death metal, the Chuck Schuldiner Experience, Death.
Understand.
Spiritual Healing from the album by the same name in 1990, I love Chuck's growl because it's actually really versatile. He goes from his low to mid-register and even does some of the flourishes in his upper range. A lot of the last album, The Sound of Perseverance, is mostly in his upper register and actually has a bit of a black metal feel to it. Some people didn't like it, but I thought it was cool as fuck. And maybe Schuldiner didn't use the upper register as much because he knew that's where Satan lives. Well, he leases, but black metal hasn't raised the rent in 40 years. They never complain about the noise, and with mortgage rates what they are, stay where you're happy, Lucifer, son of the morning. For the black metal blueprint, we need look no further than the Swedish quartet, which makes the whole thing sound much more delightful than it really is, Bathory. In 1984, Don't You Dare Do It. For the sake of your children and your children's children, you will not play another second of that Van Halen album on this podcast. Don't test me. I brought my pencil. You give me something right on, man. The years between 1983 and 1985, Bathory released their self-titled debut record. All the trappings of modern black metal are well represented on the album. Satanic imagery and subject matter, low fidelity production value, and of course, raspy, high-pitched vocals that live somewhere between an actor playing the witch character of Gertzebel at your local haunted hayride and a malevolent imp who sits on your shoulder and tells you to do bad things. Like this. The song is called Hades. The vocalist is Quarthon, I assume that's his birth name, who made four black metal albums with Bathory before pioneering the Viking metal subgenre in the early 90s, which is exactly what it sounds like. Songs about how cool it would be to be a Viking, and depending on the band, how cool it is to be racist. Unfortunately, Bathory is not exactly an exception. When I started this podcast, I didn't listen to a lot of black metal. I do now, because I've found some bands that I really love, like Psy, Autonosis, Harakiri for the Sky, and Wolves in the Throne Room. Once I realized there was black metal I really liked, I wanted to find more. But when you dig into the history of the bands that started this genre, you find out that there are not a lot of heroes. No. Not all black metal bands are Nazis, and not all sorority girls love ranch dressing, but that doesn't mean that many, if not most of them do. And they're not all explicit about it, being a Nazi, not loving ranch. That's not really how white supremacists and neo-Nazis recruit. They use codes and symbols and dog whistles, or they'll drop questionable shit into casual conversation before they escalate, like, Sweden is a very liberal country. All values are accepted except neo-Nazi and anti-Semitism. Well, yeah, I mean, maybe there's a reason for that? All Christianity comes from a Jewish fairy tale called the Bible. That is true. Why did you specify a Jewish fairy tale, though? If it's white racism, it's bad. Yes, totally agree. But if it's racism from any other color, it's fine. Ooh, I jumped in too early there. If you kill a homosexual or blow the brains out of a Jew, we shouldn't try to label these actions as racism. Oh, fuck. I picked the wrong drive-through. So those are all real quotes from Quarthon of Bathory, and here's my point, and then I'll get back to people who bark for a living. This might seem like the run-of-the-mill fucked up racist shit your uncle says when he thinks you can't tell him to fuck off because it's a family gathering. Joke's on you, asshole. I've ruined many a Thanksgiving for far less. But these are all quotes taken from interviews about his black and Viking metal bands, subgenres justifiably associated with fascist ideology, which I would think might be the best place to talk about how your band disavows or is actively opposed to fascism, because that might send the message to the actual Nazis that they aren't welcome in the musical movement that you started. But that presumes that you actually feel that way, and Quarthon clearly doesn't. I love heavy metal, but not everyone who makes heavy metal is a hero. Some of them are genuinely bad people, and some just believe genuinely bad shit. But I can't bring up their music without mentioning that they think people who murder homosexuals and Jews are treated unfairly. Because then I'm kind of saying it's okay. While recording it. And releasing it to the public. So maybe 5% of it's self-preservation and the other 95% is just, I hate Nazis. Anyway, let's end black metal on a positive note, which I believe is the first time anyone said that sentence in the history of our species. Here's the opening track off of the latest album from one of the bands I mentioned earlier, and don't worry if you can't understand the lyrics. It's black metal, so you don't have to. And unless you speak Japanese, you wouldn't anyway. From the album Shiki by the experimental Japanese black metal outfit Sai, who are, by all accounts, very good people that also happen to be very good at sounding very evil. I love Psy. One last piece of sound, and I never really wanted to do this, but I've played clips that have kind of closed out thrash and black metal, so I should probably play sound that closes out death metal. One of the things I never really wanted to do on this podcast was play Cannibal Corpse. I don't like Cannibal Corpse. I said that I tried to appreciate them in the first episode, but the truth is, I don't. I think it's repetitive and somehow aggressively boring, but really, I just have a moral aversion to their subject matter, and I'm an atheist who loves heavy metal, horror, and just evil shit in general. So I don't appreciate Cannibal Corpse bringing out my inner Tipper Gore, but that band and their aesthetic quality literally turns my stomach. I know, it's just gory fantasy storytelling and Corpse Grinder collects stuffed animals on Instagram, but that's somehow weirder to me than all the songs about rape and murder. I understand that sane, ethical, productive members of society can listen to songs like Fucked with a Knife and then pick up a salad from Kroger before the PTA meeting. I just don't want to go to that meeting. Mostly because I don't like the sound of people eating, but I also don't like the sound of Cannibal Corpse. They are, however, the best-selling death metal band of all time, with over 2 million records sold worldwide, and in the US they have outsold Death, one of the most important bands in heavy metal history, by almost 200,000 units. So you should probably know what they sound like. Here it is, against my better judgment and all my intentions when I started this podcast, Cannibal Corpse, with vocals provided by George Corpse Grinder Fisher.
C is for Cookie, that's good enough for me. C is for Cookie, that's good enough for me. C is for Cookie, that's good enough for me. Oh, Cookie, Cookie, Cookie starts with C. Oh, C is for Cookie.
Okay, obviously that's not the voice of George Fisher, and I'm sorry. That's the original singer for Cannibal Corpse, Chris Barnes, who, congratulations, just blocked you on Twitter. Because if you haven't been blocked by Chris Barnes on Metal Twitter, are you even on Metal Twitter? Anyway, that's the first and last song I'll ever play by Cannibal Corpse. And if you want to hear more, that's why streaming apps exist and why money can be used in exchange for goods and services. And so, my dear Mother Punchers, we have made our way through the genetic ancestry of thrash, black, and death vocals by way of the Homo erectus of harshness, Lemmy Kilmister. But we still have a few branches to climb on the tree of the old growlvolution: Florensis, Neanderthalus, Sapiens, and more. So don't go anywhere, because we still have to cover a whole bunch of homos. Okay,
That transition came out exactly the way I wanted it. And there's more where that came from when we come back.
God will use it.